galaxy lights, Coachella, lightning bolt necklaces. 2023 was the year of Scandoval. On March 3rd, one cheating scandal launched a reality TV investigation that generated hundreds of conspiracy theories, thousands of podcast episodes, and millions of dollars in revenue. I'm Jody Walker, host of An American Scandoval, one retrospective story told in three salacious parts. Listen December 26th on the Ringer Reality feed.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk. Now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me on the other line, neither rain nor sleet nor snow, it's Andy Greenwald. And I'm not shouting Andy because I'm home in Philadelphia and I don't want to startle my mother.
Were you suggesting that I work for the Postal Service? What was the...
Yeah, like you have like a consistency of performance that rivals the United States Postal Service.
I'm not trying to take that, but thank you. Thank you. Like I exist.
Andy... it's Monday, December 18th when we're recording it. On this day in human history, we released our best episode of the year episode, which featured interviews with Chris Storer and Eben Moss-Bacharach. We were talking to them about Forks, the seventh episode of the second season of The Bear, which we christened in a long Knights Templar-esque ceremony as the best episode of television in 2023.
Technically, everything you do, you christen. Right?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. That's true.
But I appreciate
it. It's one of the benefits of the name. And yeah, I guess that's true. And Andy, today we have a mailbag episode. It's great to see you as even though we're not in the same room. I'm here on the East Coast. Man, the vibes are great. They tried to scare us off about a nor'easter. And we were like, nope, we have to fire our defensive coordinator. So we're not really worried about that.
I'm so excited that you're broadcasting live from Patricia-delphia. I'm also unclear when...
When like, you said that before to me, you texted me that, I thought you meant my mom.
Oh, yeah.
And I realized it was Matt Patricia.
You were christening Patricia-delphia. It's getting very complicated already.
Yeah.
Kaya, when is this episode airing? Because I want to be like very vague about historical facts and news developing.
Thursday.
Thursday.
Okay, so we don't have to be like, what a great Christmas
we've had,
we
like,
all had.
Three long conversations about when this episode's airing.
2024, everybody. New Year's was special.
How are you doing?
I'm great. I was saying a lot of things are really trending my way. I was saying I was the last person to really like embrace you on the West Coast, which felt nice. We spent some social time together.
Yeah.
And then also, you sent me the mailbag questions that you had selected in advance, which is fun because usually I treat these as kind of like a you know, improv exercise, like an Upright Citizens, The Herald kind of thing, where just like how quickly can I respond to something that's asking me to come up with the seven least good movies of... that I didn't like when we were recording the podcast during the pandemic or whatever.
Uh-huh.
So I feel much
more prepared.
Is that
a big picture subliminal?
Well, no, Sean would have sent me the stuff way in advance.
I did send it to you. I often think that you like going in blindfolded. I mean, you're one of the great improvisers.
Yes.
You're my little groundling. And so today is obviously a mailbag episode and Andy is prepared. And that's because I want to make the best product possible for our listeners.
Sean, when one appears in the big picture, you know, which I did recently, I don't know if you're ever on that show, but like Sean is like an old school football coordinator. You know, he sends you like the first plays are scripted. He sends you the full plan. For like the first 15 minutes. But I don't think that's us, you know?
No, because you like to have more personal anecdotes and who can really know, you can't really know another person until you start hearing them talk in the first 10 minutes of a podcast.
I agree. I agree.
Anything you want to share with our audience about life, what you've been watching, what you've been doing with yourself before we get into the first question?
Well, I just want to be the one, again, considering I'm a big fan of structure, like I want to pour a little out for the Watch of the Weekend, a segment that lasted 1 week.
I'll tell you what my Watch of the Weekend was, straight up, dog.
Yeah, that's what I want from you.
Blue Eye Samurai.
See, this, yeah. See, I want, you were going to hide this from the people, but like you've been cartoon-pilled. All of a sudden.
I don't know what's happening to me. So this was a recommendation. Remember I was telling you about the horror teens up in Portland that we hang out with?
Sure.
When we go up to see my wife's friends. So shout out to Odette. She was like, Blue Eye Samurai is really good. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, you know, I'm not, this is pre-scavenger's reign for me. Mm-hmm. So it's not like I was still in my, if it's been drawn, it doesn't count zone. Mm-hmm. And now I'm like, maybe I should be a Midnight Boy. I don't know. I don't know if they're taking applications. I don't know what's going on with me. Blue Eye Samurai was awesome. I can't wait for you to see it. There's a tremendous amount of brothel activity in it, which, so I was going to say, it's probably not like right. a daughter show for you, but okay. it's everything that people say it is.
I think that's good. My the reason I haven't watched a lot of cartoons over the years is there's just not enough sex. You know, like Fritz the Cat was like, that was my jam, you know? Yeah. So I feel like...
this is a good quarter for us. Is that cartoons fell off after Fritz the Cat.
That's the last one that really spoke to me in my worldview. Also, I do want to note, I'm sure many people in our audience are noting this as well, that we are like, you know, we're at the age that we are. We're a little bit more fixed in our opinions. You know, we're rereading the same books. We obviously like the gold and slow horses. Like, we like what we like.
Yeah.
But we are so reactive to the whims of teenagers.
Like, I know. It's crazy.
It's so, what, like, I, you know, I'm maintaining the group chat with my teenage cousins. And like, if they tell me to go one way, I run. Like, it is so important to me to remain.
To get their affirmation.
Yeah,
I know.
So this is the way you are up in Portland. So I am excited about this turn in your life. I will watch Blue-Eyed Samurai. We are going to cover it in January for sure. Do you want to watch The Weeknd from me?
Yes, of course I do.
This is also a little, this is pre-existing in my bag, but I went and saw the new movie by my guy. My fintech overlord, Aki Korosmaki. People have heard me talk about this in the podcast before. I don't know if anyone has taken my recommendation, but this guy is legitimately one of my favorite filmmakers of all time. And he has a new movie, his first in 9 years, I think, and it played at Cannes. It won the special jury prize. It's in theaters now. It was surprisingly packed on a Friday night in scenic Glendale, California. The movie's called Fallen Leaves. It is like all Korosmaki films. It is extremely deadpan. It is very, very dry and arch, but lovely story about working class people in your favorite city of Helsinki. It's an 80-minute commitment to just a wonderful, wonderful point of view. I hope people check out Korosmaki. A lot of his movies are streaming on
Criterion.
What was
the demographic breakdown of the screening?
I was blown away by this because you guys know that I'm an Aki head from way back 2 years ago. But I've since gone back and watched almost all of his movies. I love all of them almost equally. You could check out Leav or The Other Side of Hope or La Vie Boheme. A lot of them are streaming. But this movie, I think, was purchased by Mubi. So I think it's going to be streaming relatively soon. It had been playing in 2 or 3 theaters in Los Angeles for a few weeks. So I figured I could just duck in on a Friday. But you can't duck in anywhere in Glendale on a Friday. It was lit. It took me 20 minutes to find a parking space in the public garage because so many people were out hitting like the shisha huts. People were just clubbing. There's a restaurant there. Have you seen the spot in Glendale? There's a restaurant called, and I don't mean to be disrespectful. I'm sure this is a word or a name that I don't know in Armenian, but it's John.
I don't know that spot.
It's J with like 5 A's, which to me sounds like someone in Queens yelling at their husband to come get the ladder. And
right.
It's... Anyway, it was a wild scene. And all this is to say, I assumed maybe there's just like spillover from Wonka fans who were definitely not getting what they thought they were getting. But Fallen Leaves was full of like just people, Friday night
people. I can't tell because I've had some friends of mine who have been like, yo, I went when The Killer was playing in theaters for like a week or two before it was on Netflix. They were like, there was literally one other man.
I was the friend.
The
I
and
told you that.
Yeah, well, but I've had others. I know a couple more people.
Nope.
And and so sometimes you'll get experiences like that where like, you know, nobody was here at May December or whatever. Maybe it's a Netflix thing because they're anticipating being able to see it. But it also seems like movies are just out of control in LA where everybody is just like, what I want to do is go see, you know, the 35 millimeter print of this or whatever.
That is absolutely true. And we've touched on this, and I'm sure Sean and Amanda are covering this in more depth and like with more more perspective or even data. Part of me wonders if it's just like a Friday night thing where it's like you can get food and beer now in movies. So that's a fine way to spend an hour and a half or 3 hours, depending. It was fun. It was nice. I recommend Fallen Leaves.
So I mentioned Blue Eye Samurai. I am very hopeful that you and I are going to have a special episode coming up in the first week of the new year where we're going to talk about that, among other things, with an old friend. I'll just tease it that way. We have lots of old friends in our mailbox, though. Old friends and new who wanted to ask us questions about the last couple of months. And I have to say, we make a lot of fun of the X.com platform, Andy.
Mm.
Some really solid cues this time around.
Great questions, I thought.
Yeah, really, really good ones. And let's start with Ryan O'Connell's, who asked one that, like, I was trying to figure out different ways to approach this, but Ryan's question is, what's a show this year that if you gave them a redo and recasted or changed things on, would have been notably better? Now, for as fun, much fun as we like to have on this podcast, like, I don't always love being like, this person was straight up ill-prepared or ill-suited for the role. Like, but I tried to, like, in the spirit of the question, imagine a couple of different scenarios. I wanted to hear yours first, though.
I felt the same way. I had trouble with the recasting thing. There was one that came to mind, and I don't want to be unkind about it, and it was Justified City Primeval, which definitely went... We talked about this in our Best of the Year podcast, like why that show just didn't hit for us, even though the original show did so much. This is like 15th on the list of reasons, but Timothy Oliphant did have his daughter cast as his on-screen daughter, which must have been meaningful for them, but I didn't think she... I don't know how much she contributed to the end product, but I don't want to be unkind. For me, it was really more about... Justified was one of them, but I just almost randomly grabbed two or three shows that kind of missed the mark for me this year, and they were more about... They were less about casting and more about like where you put the fence down around your story area, which is to say, and this, I don't know if you agree with me on this. I don't know if people think I'm just picking on a...
So it's not about casting. It's about narrative landscaping.
Yeah. So redo or changing. So the big one for me that missed the mark this year, and people probably know this, was House of the Dragon. And there were a number of reasons. You heard me go on week after week, and maybe you stopped listening and hopefully are coming back for this episode. And hopefully this doesn't chase you away again. But I think the biggest barrier to entry for me on that show was where it chose to lay down the fence posts and start its story. And the entire first season felt like a preamble for the story it actually wanted to tell, with these giant time jumps, with these building up an investment in characters who were going to be replaced with different actors playing them over time. And my interest in Westeros is not high enough to justify that kind of investment. And I understand why narratively they felt they had to do it. But on some level, don't you think, we'll see with the second season, but if they were just like, hey, guess what? These two ladies want to kill each other with their children and their dragons.
I think we would have been able to process that information.
I would have been cool with it. Like, okay, let's go. And that to me was the big one that stood out. I think I have another smaller one.
I wonder whether or not in retrospect, it was a little bit betwixt and between, where it's like, if you want, I don't really know what the outcome of this would have been, but you could have done a whole season of the young version of these characters.
Right.
And the season finale is the time jump to them now adults and being adversaries. I'm still looking forward to the second season of House of the Dragon, but I take your point. My recast is also a plea to Hollywood, which is stop trying to make Elon Musk cool in your shows.
I love this.
And this applies to Jon Hamm in Morning Show. This applies to Clive Owen in A Murder at the End of the World. And even, not to do like a little bit of like a vandalism here, it kind of applies to Nick Offerman in Devs, where I just don't think that Hollywood has gotten its hands around the idea of the tech titan. And they want to have it be this kind of like near spiritual figure or guy who could be on the cover of GQ, and ideally both. And then everything that we read about these tech guys, like regardless of their accomplishments or whatever, is like, these dudes are not cool. Like if I close my eyes and I think of Sam Altman or Mark Zuckerberg or Elon Musk, there is no Venn diagram connection between those guys and Clive Owen.
I love this.
And Clive Owen is doing Clive Owen in A Murderer at the End of the World. And John Hamm is doing John Hamm in Morning Show. And so it's just this funny thing where I think it must be an appealing gig, you know, like to come in and just be like, you have no idea how AI has been to reshape our experience, you know, and kind of have the Master of the Universe thing going. But these people in real life are far, far stranger than that.
I love this. 10 years ago for the Grantland website, I remember writing a piece about it was a column, it was called Washington TV. And it was about House of Cards and Veep. And basically, House of Cards existed in the world, or in a world, which basically bought the narrative of what people in Washington want. They want, it was very flattering to people in Washington, not because everyone pushes journalists in front of trains, spoilers for a 10-year-old TV show, but more that they were scheming Machiavellian masters of their universes, you know, capable of great Shakespearean feats of sex, power, violence, and also soliloquy. Veep was the exact opposite of that, being like, actually, the clowns are in charge of this rodeo, and it's more, in some ways, especially with the Trump years that followed, it became clear that, like, we want the guardrails of powerful people to be important or sexy or smart or compelling or visionary, when in fact most people are just dorks doing their best or trying to hide the massive holes inside of them that they're filling with prognostications or ego or money or whatever. And I think that we are 100% ready for a vision of Sam Altman or whomever that is a lot more Veep than it is House of Cards.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Like, and I guess that you could make the argument that Silicon Valley had a little bit of that, but it's interesting to see this character pop up in different ways over the last 18 months. And for whatever the decision making behind the scenes is, like, the idea of this suave, sphinx-like, all-knowing figure with evil undercurrents is like, they just can't shake that.
No, I love this. Silicon Valley is something I thought of too, just as we're having the conversation, but Silicon Valley is also a little bit of a time capsule, because it was in an era when the people driving that industry were weird nerds, socially awkward people, but were basically just printing money. And it was like fun tulip fever, bubble time stuff. It wasn't like, these people are actively going to Lex Luthor our children's lives.
Yeah.
And also now we've lived through enough where, I mean, I've said this before, like both in, I think on this pod, but mostly in increasingly impassioned texts that I send you at 6 a.m, which is just like, I just can't fucking believe we're doing this again, because we went through 10 years of social media being like, this will save everything, and it ruined everything. And then All the same people who are now writing these pieces, like the New York Times is writing these pieces being like, social media has destroyed a generation of children. The next column is, Sam Altman, what will this visionary do for us? Like, he's not going to do anything for us.
Is that when you canceled your subscription?
That was when I canceled my subscription. Yes, that was
light as
well. That and James Bennett's, you know, searing essay about when the Times became illiberal. You know, that was
okay.
That's really what those two things together spoke to me.
So the next question comes from J3RDBRD.
Isn't that J Third Bird?
Yeah, Third Bird, something like that. And we don't usually do these kinds of hypotheticals, but this one strikes so close to home that I feel like it's in the other room right now. Question I pose to my family. You've been assigned to a lighthouse as caretaker on a remote island for the next year.
It's your first mistake, lighthouse
keepers.
You can
choose either 50 books or one preloaded streaming service. No internet, so you can't rent or buy other content other than the current library. What do you choose? The reason why this leapt out at me is because it's an annual tradition that I come back here to Philadelphia for Christmas, and I tell myself all sorts of stories. I say, Chris, Proust is sitting right there on the bookshelf, not the actual guy, the copy of Swan's Way. Search of Lost Time. It's the end of the year. Everybody says this is like the thing that taught them how to be a human being and really understand consciousness.
That's what Sam Altman said.
And I tell myself that, like, I deserve a break, and I'm going to unplug, and I'm going to stop mainlining content, and I'm going to stop looking at IG reels of guys seeing how many Zin pouches they can put in their mouth at once. And I'm going to like get off of, you know, the internet, and I'm just going to really settle in with a classic or even like an older book that I love, and just a warm, you know, like the warm bath of literature. And I just can't do it. I just don't do it. And so when I look at you, I look at Kaya, I look at the American people and God himself, and I say I would choose to take Netflix to that lighthouse.
Why? Why Netflix?
Because
not why would
Netflix
you choose
probably
books,
has, at this point, for one thing, you're kind of getting some HBO with that. You get an incredible library of movies, albeit not Turner Classic Movies, but movies.
I'm just picturing you growing out your full ginger beard, just lost in the sauce of Ballers and Insecure, being like, ah, finally prestige television.
I think that I have to admit to myself that I would probably go insane with 50 books and a year of solitude.
Mm-hmm.
And I know what you're going to say, but I took this question incredibly seriously.
How dare you? I'll
never lie to our listeners.
I'm going to give you, Chris, as a longtime Marvel guy, you know the reference I'm going to make, which is
if you take Disney Plus, like, I'm going to jump out the window.
I'm alone. Come on. Although with Hulu, it's a value add. No, I'm going to reference the Living Tribunal, the omniscient godlike figure of the Marvel Universe with three faces. Okay? So I have three answers. The first one.
That's not, there's one or the other.
Well, the third one is the truth.
Okay.
I'm telling you my process.
Okay.
You just went on a beautiful monologue about Swan's
Way. I didn't know.
Way.
I didn't know that this is what you, I didn't know you were working through the Socratic, like, kind of, go ahead.
So immediately, like you, I said books. And then I remembered that every morning I wake up and I look at a pile of at least 50 books, of which I have not read. Like, we are in trouble right now, where my in-laws are visiting, and father-in-law came in with three books that he had taken off of one of my bookshelves. And he was like, which one of these should I read? And I was like, sir, I'm not going to lie to you. I've read none of them. But please, this one looks interesting, and let me know how it is. So I can't, in good conscience, say what my heart wants to say. Then I was like, it's got to be Criterion, because if you have a year, I could finally like make a dent in like the great canon, you know.
You think so?
Of noir and Parker Posey movies, you know. I could finally watch, you know, House of Yes or whatever. But then I was like, that too would be limiting. But I didn't go Netflix. I actually said, I know this is shocking, but I landed on Max, because you get the TCM movies. So I could, mm-hmm, I could do some of that. And I actually do like watching old movies. I feel like that would make me, I feel like that would feel productive. But also you'd get the like the patina of like modernity. Like, even though it's not updating, you would have all of the HBO shows from the last few years. And not just the HBO shows. I could finally get really into the Berlanti verse. You know?
Do you think, though, if you were stuck in a lighthouse for a year as a caretaker, I think the implication here is that there's some labor involved in caretaking. I mean, you must have to scrub some stones, polish a bell or something like that.
Right.
Like, you might be like, after a long day of caretaking, I don't want to watch the classics of Bette Davis or rewatch The Sopranos.
But that's why I have Max. I could watch F-Boy Island or whatever. Like,
that's right.
It's all there for me. Also, the only lighthouse keeper that I feel any connection to in this analogy is the one in the book Annihilation, who basically makes it a few months and then melts into moss and just like becomes part of the living tapestry of a doomed world. So
yeah,
I don't.
Do you
think
know what the saddest thing would be
year.
Is like, you would be disconnected from the world, that this guy specified that you wouldn't have an internet connection. You'd be up in this lighthouse and you'd be like, you'd get back and you're like, you still looking at IG reels? Yeah, I don't do that anymore because I was in the lighthouse. And then like 2 days later, you'd be back in the trenches with me. I want to hear Kaya's answer, though, because Kaya is both a huge book maven.
Yes.
But also is known to watch Below Deck.
I also trust
South
Kaya
Pacific.
More than I trust either of us to like just do a good job.
At lighthouse keeping?
Yeah, or basically anything.
I don't know. I feel like I should say books, but my heart wants to say Peacock. Like, I should go through
this
and read the world's greatest novels, but then also Peacock has all Bravo properties since the beginning of time, and that could really keep me entertained for a long time.
Kaya, can I tell you a personal anecdote?
Yes.
On my flight back to Philly the other day, the guy who was sitting in the row in front of me, but in my eye line, was watching Real Housewives New York Ultimate Girls Trip Legacy Edition.
I'm familiar.
And I have to admit, like, I had football on my screen. I was watching the Bills game, but I was basically riveted by the action that I was following on his screen that was silent to me. And you know, my behavior on planes when it comes to watching other people's screen has been discussed before.
Oh yeah.
But I feel like I can fill in like 75% of everything that's ever happened on Real Housewives New York based on my imagination. Yeah.
That's the beauty of the Bravo properties. It's just a low barrier to entry. And so sucks you in.
I was thinking about when I got home, I was like, maybe I should rewatch what he was watching to see if I was right.
I would support that.
Okay. I spent my most recent cross-country flight staring, I don't know if it was a teen, but someone had a Nintendo Switch and was playing a game that I could not identify, but I spent the whole, but it was about like a white-haired like anime girl in a role-playing universe, but she could turn into a bird. And I was like, I'm going to be dad of the year. This game is perfect. I was just like, this can't be too hard. I'll see some characteristic of this game that I will then be able to purchase. I'm just crowdsourcing. Because let me tell you, when you Google girl role-playing game Nintendo, it's not a happy story. It's not what you want.
Yeah.
That's why I just had to restart my computer.
That's probably right. That's why you had the rainbow of death. This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details. Andy, Brandon McShane wants to know, where would Chernobyl rank on your 2023 list and the list from the year it originally aired? And, you know, we did Chernobyl as like a, we fucked up watch. Like we were wrong. This was amazing. As great as everybody said it was. And I'm kind of looking for something similar to do, whether it's a thing that, you know, we both haven't seen or maybe a revisit for next year. I have some ideas, but Chernobyl obviously was a pretty amazing viewing experience for me this year, and also slightly or to modestly embarrassing that we had sort of dismissed it like dickheads before. Where would it have ranked for your 2023 list?
I love this question. Honestly, it may have been number one, but it forced a tough conversation with myself for 45 seconds this morning when I opened the Google document you shared. It's such an amazing achievement, and an achievement like full achievement in that the entire series is essential, and the payoff and the weight of it and the cumulative effect of its vision, like the performances, it's the heaviness of the political themes, the production design, that it almost feels like an outlier, that I feel like I could have said, yeah, this is number one because The Bear is an ongoing experience and pleasure, but like Chernobyl just landed. That would then have opened up a more interesting debate about what we're looking for week to week or month to month or year to year in TV. So In a way, I'm glad we didn't have to have that argument, because I don't know how you compare one solid statement to three examples of the best episodic guest offer. Now, there have been years when we've had those conversations. So
it was also interesting to watch it almost completely outside of the context of it being like this phenom when it was on in 2000. Was it 19 that it came out?
It was 2019, yeah.
And so to watch it almost as a bit and be like, oh, well, that's a masterpiece. Everybody was right. It's different than watching something like Succession or Barry or The Bear, which were our top three shows, and kind of like figuring out where it fits in that group, if you know what I mean. Like it's a very interesting exercise, actually. If it was this year, I don't really know, in the same way Andy's saying, like the level of achievement is so total the filmmaking, especially, there's a depth of the world that it's depicting that I feel like was pretty much unparalleled this year. That being said, like, you know, I think it's like that there were things in the TV year this year that made me feel different things than Chernobyl. I think that there's, it's important to kind of like play different notes sometimes. I'm trying to think though. I think it would definitely be in the conversation for one or two. I talked about on our podcast about how for me, Succession and The Bear were kind of in a tier by themselves. And then it was stuff below that. Mm-hmm. I think Chernobyl would have been in that tier though.
I don't have my top 10 from 2019. I like that part of the question, but I didn't prepare for it.
Yeah, that was like Fleabag, Succession. I think it definitely would have been top two or three if I had been a professional and watched it when it came out.
Yeah, I don't have access to my list, but like how could we not? But I know it runs counter to the twice weekly podcast. God, that was fun to have waiting for us. That really was, I enjoyed that a lot.
Yeah. I hope that we can do one next year. I had thought about maybe doing a Band of Brothers mm-hmm. watch with you because you said you hadn't really seen that since it came out, right?
And I didn't even, I don't think I finished it when it came out. I just sort of...
Do you want me to tell you how it ends?
With Tom Brokaw, right? Just reading from his books over the years?
Here's one from Stephen Lurie that I wanted to hear your takes on because I think he's almost... This is in conversation with some of your comments at the beginning of our year-end podcast. Are we pre, post, or in a peak of alternatives to the genre and narrative conventions of serialized TV? So Steven says, thinking about formal twists, so Rehearsal, Jury Duty, Kaleidoscope, as well as limited and anthologies, White Lotus, Beef, and Black Mirror, will things get weirder or blander? I think you could take this in a bunch of different ways, Andy, but I'm curious what your reaction to the question was.
Blander. It's easy. I mean, it's easy. But I should say, as with everything, like, all it takes is one visionary thing slipping through, and then everyone runs to chase after that. I think we're witnessing at the moment of sort of it's an unfortunate two-tailed after effect of the last few years where, yes, there's contraction. Yes, there's less risk-taking. There will be fewer shows. People are trying to spend less money, and that will result in safer, you know, at least choices that people presume to be safer. So in that case, we will not be having as many formalist risk-taking programs. And then also, this, whatever the current crop of new shows is always chasing the last crop of successful shows. And those weren't necessarily genre-breaking, you know, formalist shows. So I think it's almost guaranteed that it's going to be blander. And in fact, I would kind of separate out the question because I think The Rehearsal is pretty wild. Jury Duty doesn't strike me as that groundbreaking in the sense.
Jury Duty just, I think it's sort of conceit and its twist is quote unquote nuts, but it's not, it's actually like closer to Modern Family than it is Twin Peaks.
And it's wild cheap, which I think is a thing to note. You know, I think as long as you can take your risks for under the budget of normal scripted shows, you might get a chance to make your
risk. And that's a really good point.
To take
the
your
more
risk.
That things are like, it's either a massive hit, like it's either like a huge blockbuster kind of thing, or it's very low budget. I mean, the formal invention is going to come from the lower budget stuff.
I also think that if you look at the three examples that Stephen gave us, White Lotus, Beef, and Black Mirror, Black Mirror is grandfathered in from a previous generation. I don't know if Black Mirror starts.
And it originated in England, so yes. It wasn't like Netflix was like, this is a great idea, let's do it.
White Lotus is, you know, in many ways a one of one, but it is also an ongoing show that has one of the most valuable recurring characters of all, which is sex and glamour. Like that's going to guarantee multiple seasons for it, and that doesn't seem particularly risk-taking, even though I think Mike White does a lot of interesting things with it, and I don't mean to criticize the show because I'm a big fan. And then Beef is a question mark, because when we were talking about it in the top 10 episode last week, Beef might get renewed. It just might be a show. I also wonder how much of this is the Netflix effect, because like A24 being like, we're going to work with, you know, interesting filmmakers and cool actors, and we're going to bring this to market. They did that with The Curse, and it ended up on Showtime, which kind of doesn't even exist anymore. And you and I are going to keep watching it and talking about it, but that isn't a sensation. So what makes Beef successful? Is it A24 and the storytelling language of Lee Sung-jin and his collaborators, or is it Netflix? I don't know. So, yeah, I think things are going to get blander for a while. Because also, think about the big swings that we got in the last year. You were talking about some of them on the top 10, like Extrapolations. You know, like Apple could make 5 extrapolations a year for the next decade and not blink, but they're not going to because it didn't connect on any of the levels that even make sense for them.
Yeah, that whole like an anthology series about an issue that is affecting people now, it seems harder and harder to imagine that continuing to be greenlit outside of like, you know, the sort of feel-good vanity of studios being like, yeah, it's important that we make a show about this. It's like, yeah, but none of these have actually hit. You know, none of these have actually like kind of accomplished what they set out to do, I don't think.
We're going to...
Which is save the world. So it's a little difficult, but still.
Like, you and I are intrigued about what FX has done and by making it, but also what will become of Shogun, right? That's a very expensive thing that's happening in February, and it's pretty clear there's not... I mean, I can't imagine there's going to be a Shogun expanded universe. I think it's like, let's take a big swing on something.
Yeah.
Shogun was greenlit years and years ago, and what's getting greenlit now are hospital and cop shows.
I guess my only wrinkle to this answer here, or my contribution would be, a lot of the times the things that I respond to and think are sort of... revelatory on television have to do, with all due respect to the writer in the room, with the filmmaking. Mm-hmm. So,
okay, Sam.
No, I just think that, like, take 000, which is a show that I reference a lot that was on Amazon Prime a few years ago and is an international drug trafficking story. There's a different version of that show that is much more down the line and straightforward. And I think the writing on that show is very, very good. And it's the breadth of its storytelling and the courage to be like, we're going to tell these three different sort of, these three plots that wind up intertwining over the course of a 10-hour season is great. But I think I responded a lot to Stefano Soluma's filmmaking and to the use of Mogwai as the soundtrack. And there's, as long as there's still things like that that take chances in that department, I think you can see the AB, you know, it's like there's the sort of straightforward down the middle version of it. And then there is the like, who let this guy do this this?
I totally agree with that. I think one thing to consider also is how much the streamer or network plays a role in that. And also just ultimately budget. When we were talking about the previous question about like redos or recasting, an interesting what if for me is Mrs. Davis, which was on Peacock. And that's our friend Damon Lindelof's show. And I think we both really enjoyed it, and it went for it. And that's the thing that I loved most about it.
Yeah.
And I love Betty Gilpin, and I think the filmmaking was good, and there are a lot of great actors on it. But I am curious what the version on HBO would have been. Damon is under an overall of Warner Brothers. They ended up making the show for Peacock. And I want to be careful talking about this because I don't want to disparage anyone who is involved in making a very ambitious and not cheap show. But absolutely, when you're making something that has like carte blanche imagination, like Mrs. Davis did for a essentially carte blanche budget network like HBO, it's different. And how much does that move the needle? Where does that money go? Does the money go into casting up one or two small parts in a way that's surprising or makes you take notice? Is it just in terms of location? Are there things that they couldn't do that they had to walk themselves back from? And
that's, you know, a really good example. Like, think of Succession if it was all in sound stages.
Exactly. And Mrs. Davis was not all in sound stages. And Owen Harris is a good director. So it's a flawed example, but it's something to consider when you think about what we mean when we say ambitious.
Yeah. And I just meant that more, not as a slight of Mrs. Davis, more like, it doesn't always have to be some hotshot director. It can be something like you can take material and if you do what Mark Mylod and Adam McKay and Jesse Armstrong came up with to come up with like a visual language for that show and just spend the money on being in Croatia on the coast or whatever. It's just going to feel different than it would if you were like, here we are in Vancouver, but this is downtown Vancouver, you know?
Yep.
Okay, let's move on to another question. I have one from Peter Dennis. What's the best example of a movie that should have been a TV show in 2023 or a TV show that should have been a movie? So I have kind of an unfair example for this should have been a movie, but just because it came up a few times when we talked about their shows this year were any number of Apple TV shows. I think they especially tend to adapt literary properties that 30 years ago just would have been like totally doubles to left movies, maybe even award fodder, maybe about blockbuster stuff. And I'm referring even to our beloved Hijack, which is something that would have just been either like Idris Elba's Taken or Idris Elba's Air Force One, It just would have been like a really good 90 minutes, 2 hour action movie that came out either in Dumpuary or in the summer. I'm glad it didn't, but that's an example of something that story-wise,
yeah,
when you really boil it down, you probably could have squeezed out that in a movie format.
I think
but
that's
this applies
the right,
definitely.
That's the right, I'm sorry to cut you off, but that's the right example. I feel like the project of Hijack was let's reverse engineer a 90s movie into a 2023 television show. And yeah. I think they were successful.
And it'll be fascinating, like assuming they're making a second season of Hijack. You know, they just started airing in England a second season of Vigil, which, you know, is this murder mystery set on a nuclear submarine that I enjoyed quite a bit. This one, I think, is set in a plane, but like they've basically taken, it's now a detective show with Saran Jones. And like, so like, I think it's just supposed to be like her kind of Sherlock or whatever. I can't wait for that to come out, but that's an example of one where they're like, well, we just like the person in this kind of a situation. So I don't know if Idris is coming back for Hijack and they're going to put this guy in another similar situation, or if you apply it to a different kind of fixer solver kind of character. But yeah, I think you can apply this to Lessons in Chemistry. I think you can apply it to Extrapolations. You could have picked one of those stories to tell as a movie. There's a few different ones. I do have a movie that I thought would have been an interesting TV show, but I want to let you go first.
Yeah, let me do the TV one. I agree with you about the Apple stuff. Lessons in Chemistry was a miss from both of us, but I think that there's a version of it. I don't know if Curtis Hanson directed that in 2004, I'd be like, yeah, sure. You know, that's a fine time spent. It did not need to be that long. I think there are a lot of examples of what you were talking about with Hijack, of like, I understand just both on a creative level, but also more importantly, I guess in this case, on a executive level, why you're trying to reconstruct these formerly movie vibes as TV shows. And then they fall so flat to me because it's just not a one-to-one. And the biggest examples of that this year, I think, were Citadel. You remember that?
Oh,
that's
yeah.
the incredibly, incredibly troubled, expensive Russo Brothers spy show on Amazon. With,
remember
Richard...
when the fucking DoorDash bag is on that guy's table in the first episode?
But like the mandate from that was just like, give me a sexy world of spies, but also for TV, but also an unlimited budget. I mean, it was a mess.
And it was also like, we can adapt this to every language all over the world. It can be like a multi-market global phenomenon.
There's a cynicism to it that I think, you know, if you just take the conceit
Russos?
Of... I know, never that. By the way, you're the one in a lighthouse watching The Gray Man for a year, so you could get back to me on that. But also, at Netflix, All the Light We Cannot See...
You're like, just me and my Dream On reruns.
I had some pleasant memories of watching Dream On.
I bet you do.
Yeah, sure did. See, we took what we could get in the 90s. Like All the Light We Cannot See, which... I feel unfair picking on because I've just not engaged with, but the way people talk about the book versus the way they talk about the Netflix miniseries makes me yearn for the days like Lassie Hallström adapting this and then Miramax recutting it and it's still getting nominated for Oscars. It's like, that's fine. A B- is fine. Two other quick ones in this category. It got by on vibes and made my top 10 list, but we talked about how Daisy Jones and the Six was a major tweener, either 2.5 hour movie or 4 seasons. But it got by on vibes is what it was. And I don't want to criticize it. Kind of a hot take as a last one. You know what I'm starting to think could have been a more successful movie? Fargo season 5.
Yep. Would it be the version where it's the cat and mouse game and you just strip all the mythology and the weirdness, or would there still be room for the weirdness?
Well, I think that's when you get into, and it's just an impossible exercise because the success of that show is Noah Hawley retrofitting one movie and its vibes into a now long-running TV series. So you can't turn it back into the original movie, but so far to me, the strengths of the season have come from the times when Noah was at his most focused, and we know from the way he spent the last few years that Noah is also very interested in making movies and would like to make another movie again. And the strength of the first 2 episodes of the season, it was very strong when it was more focused. Like, here's a story, they're chasing her, this is happening. And then as it's kind of been like, and also 500 years ago, there's a Sin Eater, and now there's some Raising Arizona, it has become much, it's dissipated to me. There's still a lot of good things there, but it is not as focused.
Yeah, I hope we catch up with that show. I mean, we kind of lost it in the flow of the year-end stuff that we had to do. But I mean, I'm an episode or two behind on Fargo, but I would like to have a longer conversation with you.
Yeah, I agree.
Season's coming to an end. I did want to throw this one out there just randomly. It's a 2022 movie that I, in retrospect, I'm not saying it's better as a TV show, but I would like to see it. I would like to have the conversation. As Bill likes to say with trades, are you saying you don't take the meeting? You know, are you saying you don't have the phone call?
I've heard him say it.
Because of Ferrari, which is coming out on Christmas with Adam Driver as Enzo Ferrari, I've been thinking a lot about Adam Driver. And, you know, he was just on Saturday Night Live. We talked about that the other week. One of our best conversations in a long time, I thought, was me being like, Saturday Night Live is pretty funny when Adam Driver's on it.
And I just stared at you. I thought that was cool.
White Noise. Noah Baumbach's adaptation of White Noise. Mm-hmm. And I was re-watching it the other day just because I was just going through some Driver
just
stuff.
Just in your lighthouse.
Yeah, just me. Well, it's on Netflix, you know?
All the lighthouse
you
cannot see.
I got to
the
end of Love is Blind, and I was like, what time? And you know what else is on Netflix is a series of short-ish films that Wes Anderson made this year.
Yes, we never talked about those. I really enjoyed that.
These adaptations of Roald Dahl books. And part of what I thought was really important to me, or, you know, is awesome to me about the book White Noise is the distinction between the sections. Like,
yes,
the sections have not only like different narrative kind of concerns, but also like they have different tonal characteristics, and that's harder to maintain or switch up in, it's hard to, you know, change your tone of your movie midway through. Cause people are like, wait, I thought I was sitting down for a disaster movie and now it's like this absurdist comedy or whatever. But in the DeLillo book, it kind of is consistent in its change. And I wonder whether or not there's a version of White Noise that would have made a lot of sense as three discrete statements.
Yeah, like, I think that's good.
Closely mapped against the book and, you know, maybe got to live in the rhythms of the DeLillo sentences, you know, like there is a certain like kind of absurdity to the way people talk in the book that I think the movie got at, but felt a little stressed in its compressed timeline.
You know, what's funny is I've heard a lot of people say this in my personal and professional life. And I feel like I've heard it, people talking about this or joke about it on podcasts like The Town, like the idea that TV is contracting and movies are back, baby. Mm-hmm. Just if you just simply look at what's getting made and where the money is, that's not true. But it is true in regard to what you're saying, because 5 years ago, or anywhere between 5 and 10 years ago, Noah Baumbach putting that together as a miniseries for HBO or Netflix or whomever buyer would make sense for the marketplace the way it was. Doesn't mean it would have been successful in any way, but I think someone would have greenlit it as a series and maybe tried to sell international rights or whatever. I don't think networks and streamers see the upside in that very much anymore. Yeah. Because certainly Netflix doesn't really need to make the prestige play. So in a way, it's easier for them for someone like Noah to do that as a movie, because for whatever reason, Netflix is still in business with him as a movie maker. And he does, you know, and they make these movies, they put them in theaters, they go for Oscar stuff. But that's an example where, that's an interesting example, because the TV show actually makes more sense in some ways, but the movie's what gets made. I have a hot take one for a movie that should have been a TV show. Do you want to go first though? Maybe we have the same
one. No, but my movie to TV was White Noise.
That was it. Okay, I didn't know if you had a 2023 one. I've got one, and I want to preface it by saying this should never happen, and I disagree with myself.
Okay, but are you going to say Oppenheimer? Because if you do, we're going to stop the pod.
No, there's only one. But when I say this, I don't want to remove the movie from the world. I think the movie is brilliant. But Killers of the Flower Moon is an incredible miniseries. And in some ways, it would be a completely different piece of narrative storytelling, because you could delve into so much more history, so much more context, so much more place, so much more time passing. Now, and in some ways, it would be, quote unquote, more accurate to history or to David Grant's book, right? And you could fold in more of the founding of the FBI stuff that is baked into it. I don't want any of that, because I love 80-year-old Marty being like, this is my story, and it is about America.
The thing that's great is Andy, he worked so cost-effectively on that film that like you could do a bunch of different things there.
It's true. But do you know what I mean, though? Like, it was so interesting to walk out of that and be like, this is an example of something that in most outcomes becomes a prestige miniseries. And but Marty, through force of will and star power and clout and legacy, just made it kind of a personal movie.
Right.
So, but it would have been a rich text to explore in a different format.
While I was on my flight, another piece of voyeuristic watching people watch things, I watched a woman watch the first 45 minutes of Killers of the Flower Moon on her phone.
That's disheartening.
And then she switched to Gilmore Girls. I mean, maybe she was like, I got to save this for my flat screen. I don't know.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, her home theater.
Yeah.
She's most. Like,
I don't think that this is the way Rodrigo Pietro wanted me to project this. Okay. Next question comes from Chris Colton. We've gotten versions of this question before, and we've always had like an answer, although I don't know necessarily that you do. Do you guys have any guilty pleasures? It might be impossible, the amount of content that you have to cover, but I'd love to know. It's the challenge on MTV for me. Long live the GOAT at Johnny Bananas. He's also a Ringer Podcast Network contributor. Thanks. I'll hang up and listen. So I think I was really curious to see if you had an answer here, because I think that you are like, my watching time is dedicated to things that I think at least have a decent shot of being relevant to my work. Not like it's just TV time.
Yeah, I don't.
Here
I never turn the TV
on. House. Right.
Unless I'm watching something with intention for myself or the podcast or sports. But I think I've said this before, that like my guiltiest pleasure that I will just watch, regardless if I can find a way to make you watch it too, is any and all Netflix shows about old people eating food in Tokyo.
How many shows are there?
Like, you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised. Like, you know, I
so
remember
it's literally watching old people eat. It just happens in
it's
Tokyo.
Not always old people, but like Samurai Gourmet, like that was an old guy.
You brought that up like 14 times.
I know, but like Midnight Diner, Tokyo Stories I've talked about, and they're just slow paced and nothing really happens, but people eat and I love it. And I'm sure there's some I'm not thinking of, but like, yeah, the rare times when I'm just doing a scroll, Netflix is insidious and they're like, you might like this. And it's just like show about an old Korean lady making something. Like, okay. Yeah, I'll do that.
Okay. So for me, I don't really feel guilty about watching SVU all the time, but I do think that sometimes when I have to explain what the last thing that went into my brain before I went to sleep was, and it's like, it's some of the most deranged things that the human mind can comprehend. I do wonder what it does to like my dream life and also just my soul. But as far as more like kind of classical guilty pleasures, I watched Love is Blind for the first time this year. I watched this past season with my wife at her preferred 1.5 speed.
Wow.
Which will really melt your fucking synapses.
Kaya has never paid more close attention to something you've said than what you just said.
And
her body
language changed. Wife just kept saying, Kaya, feel free to chime in. She was just like almost like hurt or ashamed that we were watching it, because she was like, this is an atypical Love is Blind season. You're not getting enough proposals and weddings. Is that true?
I didn't watch this last season of Love is Blind, though I do respect the 1.5 move. I think I'd like to do that for like The Bachelor sometimes. There's just a lot of filler.
You're not missing. It's not Tony Gilroy writing this thing. Like there's not a lot of turns of phrase that you're missing. You can get it.
Can I make a comment? Of a judgment. If you're watching something at 1.5 speed, you feel guilty about it. Like you shouldn't, but that's a sign that you think you're doing something wrong and you should be using your time differently.
No, I think it's like, but it's also just like, as what do they call them? Dinks with dual income, no kids. As that's what like.
I have never. Is that like the mouse in your pocket?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the thing. We probably have more time to watch television, and it's not always like what
that was
we
the
really
softest
is,
probably in history. Very gracious. Thank you.
Thanks. It's just something we do. You know, we have. I don't know what to say.
Just make casual purchases and watch television.
I don't think that there's anything that much stranger for me to watch Love is Blind at 1.5 than people who listen to podcasts at 1.5.
Oh, no one does that.
What are you talking about? Almost everybody does that.
No one who listens to this podcast does. I defy you to. I think
Sean does.
I choose to pretend that no one does that.
Kaya, is there a way to figure out how many people listen to us at normal speed?
I would never share that statistic with Andy.
But don't you think it's, do you think there's like some ironic, just like chef's kiss energy to someone hearing me say that no one listens to my voice sped up when I sound like Mighty Mouse in their ears right now on the subway? I like that.
They've got you in one ear and they've got like Raheem Palmer in the other ear.
Just two Philly guys. Like, I don't know if people know this until Kaya just broke the seal on it, that I am like a no, I'm a no data guy. Like, I want no data. I want no feedback. I want no ratings information. I want to know nothing. It's just me hanging out with my pals in DTLA, the Arts District. Yeah. Like, is there an analogy to that? Is there someone in sports who, you know, just purely
I think
about...
that's how Joe Biden governs. Don't show him the polls, man. Just let him cook.
He's got this. Yeah, it's good. We're both going to have a great year.
Okay, Scrap HM. Could you name the most perfect season of a TV show as far as plot, action, theme, motif, not to mention acting, cinematography, and dialogue? Mine would be Deadwood Season 1. That is a very, very good answer. I sometimes like these canonical questions and just going off the top of the dome. And you know what the first thing that jumped to mind was?
Hmm.
Succession Season 2.
Oh, yeah, it's a good one.
I also have Friday Night Lights Season 1, Wire Season 3, and Justified Season 2.
Yeah, this was a tough one because I think my answer is no, I can't. I thought about Friday Night Lights also, but then I remembered, because I've been rewatching it a little bit, like it's like 20 episodes in Season 1.
But I respect that.
It's tonally what I take away from it is perfect, but there's a lot of filler, I would say. Overall, you know, especially considering that was the time, that's how long shows were. I also feel like this is a challenge because are we excluding things like one season wonders, you know, that are essentially like long movies and that they weren't ever going to do anymore. So like Top of the Lake or Chernobyl, we were mentioning, even recent examples like Watchmen. I mean, and also, frankly, like
those are all really good answers.
The Bear season 2 has no skips, you know,
yeah.
But my other Mad Men season 5 would potentially be on my list. But I came down to Wire Season 3 and Fleabag Season 2.
I would like to go back and watch Fleabag Season 2 again.
Well, I know a lot of people who watched it many, many, many times.
Yeah. I find myself very mystified by the Phoebe Waller-Bridge post-Fleabag experience.
I think you're not alone.
Where's she at?
Like, she's not carrying on the Indiana Jones franchise.
No. But, you know, I'm not concern trolling at all. I'm just like, just drop the album, Phoebe.
My thing, maybe she just wants to like make an instrumental flute album. Maybe she's just Andre 3000. Like she did one thing that was great.
And Andre 3000 did a lot of things.
This is the widest lens possible. But I'm like, he did a rapper in Outkast great and is one of the greatest rappers of all time. But I wouldn't say that like his performance in Four Brothers or even his very nice flute album is as good. And that's okay.
The thing that's surprising to me, too, is that when you look at the stuff that she nominally did to the extent, like, you know, as an executive producer, but she wrote a lot of Killing Eve Season 1.
Mm-hmm.
She's done rewrite work on Bond. She's done rumored polishes on things. She was attached to this Mr. and Mrs. Smith for a while. It's not like she's like, I want to make a Maya Darren movie. You know, it's like she's definitely coloring within the lines and doing some really interesting shit in there. And so I wonder what it is that is like, maybe it's just like development and like we're waiting to find the right thing.
No, we know what she's doing. She's doing Tomb Raider for Amazon. That's what she's doing.
Yeah, but she was doing Mr. and Mrs. Smith. You know what I mean? Like, I'll believe it when I see it.
I'll believe it when I see it too. But that, from what I understand, that is the stick and the carrot, I think, in her very expensive Amazon deal. They were like, make this for us. Do this.
Okay.
I don't even think she's starring in it, but I think she is. That is her. Maybe she's going to. I don't know. But that's what she's doing. But I think it's interesting to consider her career, considering she made something that we hold up as like the pinnacle of this era of television or one of them. And then now she's just back in the marketplace of like, I'm doing a franchise thing and I'm doing a Star Wars robot. And then I have to do a video game for Amazon to justify my existence. There's a version of it where it's sucks.
Let's go rapid fire on the last couple of these.
Yeah.
Just so we can get through more questions from more people who wrote in here. Baked Lakers fan. What favorite writer, director, or viewers do you want to see create their first TV show? My pick would be QT because of the writing. he would make a mean 70s or 90s show. I still wonder. Let me ask you this. This is a yes or no question. Would you see Quentin Tarantino moving into long form storytelling via television to be a positive or a negative for the culture? Because like, I know that there are some people who are cinema purists who are like, to rob us of this great director who's going to stop making features after The Critic, or reportedly, for him to go and make, you know, TV would be like a disappointment. But I don't know. It's ultimately, I think if you net out with more Quentin Tarantino, you're probably happier at the end of the day.
I think he stays in movies. I think he ought to stay in movies. I think making statements, complete statements, that's just a wonderful thing to do in an artistic career and increasingly rare. I would not be against the Twin Peaks model, which is to say a 70s cop show dreamed up by Tarantino where he writes and directs the pilot and then hands it off to someone. Or if Paul Thomas Anderson wrote a soap operatic drama pilot set in the San Fernando Valley in the 80s and then gave it to someone. Mm-hmm. And in that circumstance, like, the pilot is going to be the most important and best episode, but you get to sort of play in that sandbox in a way more directly connected to the original intent than, say, what Noah's doing with Fargo, which, again, I'm not saying that to disparage it, but he's just picking up the pieces that were left behind. The Coen brothers had nothing to do with the show. So I would love people to do that, but I think those guys in particular, or other, you know, of their filmmaking peers who only work in one medium, like Wes Anderson, they're just too finicky. They're too controlling, which is fine. It makes good art.
In much the same way where I would imagine like Sean would cringe if I was like, let's make Quentin Tarantino do TV. My nominee for this, the answer here is Kelly Freeman Craig, who did Edge of 17 a few years ago and Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. Two lovely, lovely movies. I just saw Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. I hadn't seen it when it was out in theaters. Rachel McAdams is amazing in that. Obviously, like, she's sort of I don't want to go as far to say apprentice, but she has been mentored a bit by James L. Brooks. And she makes a kind of movie that is increasingly rare these days, which is, you know, character study, people talking, the stakes are very regular, normal life, everyday life. I do wonder whether or not if, like, she could just make the best high school show of the last 15 mm-hmm. years, or if she could make a great workplace dramedy and what that would be like. And maybe it would be a kind of situation where she gets it set up and turns it over to other people, but I'm happy to have her keep making movies for as long as she possibly can. Question.
Let me answer. That was a great pick. I have longtime listeners won't be surprised.
I thought you. Yeah, my bad.
Nicole Holofcener. I love Nicole Holofcener. She's one of my favorite filmmakers. She made a great movie this year with Julie Louis-Dreyfus called You Hurt My Feelings. It's sort of in keeping with your pick because she makes wonderful slice of life, complete statement movies. Walking and Talking, Kicking and Screaming, Enough Said, Friends with Money, Please Give. And they are cinematic. They're cinematic in a way that I think we overlook. You know, cinematic doesn't mean Aquaman 2. Like, you can just pick your characters, set them loose, and bring it home in a beautifully considered way. And I hope she keeps making movies forever. But I've never understood why she hasn't been given the opportunity to create her own TV show, because what she excels at more than anything is beautiful characters who seem real, who talk, and who are funny and have emotional depth. And that's what I want in a TV show. So I'm still holding out hope that...
Yeah, she's like a veteran TV director.
Yeah, she does a lot of work in TV.
Sex in the City and Gilmore Girls. She directed two episodes of Lucky Hank this year.
She directed Parks and Recreation. She plays in TV. And I think she was on this podcast this year and I asked her about it. I mean, I think she's interested, but it's never come together, and I kind of wish it did.
Okay. Next question comes to us from The Poison Drip Through, and the question is, what preview or trailer has gotten you the most hype for a TV or movie ever? This is inspired by the trailer for Alex Garland's Civil War. I have an immediate answer for this.
Mm-hmm. Hit me.
No Country for Old Men.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
I was the guy going up to people with tears in my eyes being like, sir. All the homies got Anton Sugar haircuts after this.
I want to see that picture of like me and the fellas. 2007. Yeah. you, me, Chuck, just everybody from that era with the haircut. I had to be honest. Like, I got to send it back. Like, if I think about, like, what is the trailer that stopped time and that I, as someone who engaged with culture, parsed like it was the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's Phantom Menace. It's Phantom Menace, senior year. Like on a dial-up QuickTime video, being like, holy shit, they made more Star Wars. It's coming out on my birthday. I bet this is going to be sick. That guy's got two lightsabers in one.
They can take Darth Maul's saber from your cold, dead hands. Like
you know, canonically, he's not dead. The cartoon said so. No, I mean, that's why I never trusted a trailer again. But that was a beautiful moment.
So as Andy mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, we're recording this on December 18th. We're just hours away from the Eagles taking on the Seattle Seahawks on Monday Night Football. Jalen Hurts has flown to Seattle in a separate plane because he's so racked with flu. They didn't want him to give it to the rest of the team. The Eagles have changed defensive coordinators midweek, even though they're 10-3. We do not know the outcome of this game. So supposedly this could change overnight. But I wanted to end our podcast with a question from Amy Carter. On the sports mania spectrum, I am like 95% Andy. How do I scoot even a little closer to Chris's healthy Zen-like perspective? Tips, tricks, or perspective?
Yeah, I'd like to. I'll just sit back and listen because I'm a mess. I am not a well person. I've been deeply unhappy for weeks. I internally am the Eagles front office. I'm just making panic moves all the time.
Yeah, you fired your DC.
I'm just not a reliable emotional.
What if you moved one daughter to the box and the other daughter was brought down to the field?
What if I relieved one of her daughterly duties? She's still a daughter in name only.
Yeah.
But
I guess I have to say that I think part of this is that would you say I'm more even keel than you, generally speaking?
I've been thinking about this a lot recently, and I'm come to the conclusion that I think that's true. I think that's true.
Okay, so there's some like just nature versus nurture kind of stuff going on here where I think I also don't necessarily like get too far over my skis when I'm happy. Like I get psyched. Like there's an Instagram video of me reacting to the Eagles winning the Super Bowl, and I stand by every word I said that night.
You tackled me.
I did. And so like I am capable of the highest of highs and of course the lowest of lows. But like for sports, I think because it became professionalized for me about 10 or 15 years ago when I was like, okay, I have to start like covering this. And it didn't take any of the magic out of it, but like you simply cannot live like that. You know, like it's really hard to be like, I live and die with the results of teams.
Yeah.
If you're also like, I also have to make content out of it and talk about it like casually and professionally all the time. That being said, like I said to you before, man, I love watching games with my dogs, you know, like to me, it's like, that's happy hour. That's the time when we're all together and we high five the wins. And we say, get them next time on the losses. And I know that
we did spend a real dark, I mean, like it was just dark out decade in like cold New York bars where you go in and it's daylight and we're like, the Eagles will win. And then Andy Reid bungles the clock management and you just emerge blinking and a little bit day drunk into just dark, freezing night.
Yes.
And we got through it. But I feel like there's a deeper truth here that we're getting at in terms of like, maybe this is the holiday spirit talking now. But like, you know, I think for a long time, there's an impression that I was carrying partly, you know, you fronted a hardcore band, you moved quite spastically on stage, you threw yourself into it with, you know, wild abandon.
Yeah.
You famously, you know, we would make a lot of stops in the New Jersey Turnpike at Cinnabon or restrooms. Like you didn't sit still so much. And I was like, I must be like a real anchor to Chris.
Yeah, I know.
Guess what, guys?
Turned.
Guess what? It's a long season.
By the way, just because I have a weak bladder, it was not because I was going to like Cinnabon to like
rob it. No, I wasn't making any illusions otherwise. But I was just like, you know, we were buckling in for a long ride in traffic.
But I would come out without my shirt covered in cream cheese icing.
I'm just saying,
drive.
I'm just saying, life is a long season, and as it turns out, I'm a mess. You're my anchor, and I'm grateful for it.
I don't know what to say. Like, this team, this Eagles season, this Sixers season, like, Philadelphia sports, it'll do a number on your head if you let it. So, I feel bad for you, though.
I feel bad. So what's Amy's advice here? I just think it's just like,
I'm supposed to give Amy advice. And I think that the nice thing about sports is there is always another game. So, like, you just have to think about it that way. Like, that's what I was sort of saying, where I was like, we're riding a little too high early in the season. Like I don't mind being 8-5, you know, like some things to work on. We're doing these things right, but we're doing these things wrong. Like it's the 10-2 that kills you.
I agree. I just think that the other thing about...
That's the Icarus zone.
The other issue with getting old, though, is like you begin to realize that maybe once a decade you have a team that could be in it, and it's real fun.
You know how many people are listening to us and saying, like, these fucking guys just won a Super Bowl and they're crying about being 10-3?
I'm not crying on this podcast. I save that for our text.
No, but like in general, like us being like, oh, yeah, no, yeah. The Eagles. No. Like, it's like, dog, you know, there's some...
But they're right. I am
They're
here.
Lions fans in this world.
I am here like a supplement. I'm like, I'm a mess. This is absurd behavior. I do not apologize for it. I mean, I do not condone it. I do apologize for it. They're right. But I can't contain it. So Amy, let us know how it goes. She didn't even say what her chosen poison is.
I just assume every person is an Eagles fan.
Well, they should be.
Why would you not be, you know?
Yeah, clearly we're so well adjusted and happy.
When I was on the flight coming back here, I don't even know if I should share this story because it sounds really ghoulish, but an offensive lineman for the Cowboys got like pretty injured. And there were like 5 fist pumps.
It's sick. Look, this is disease. Yeah. But you know, I have it. I got the bird flu.
You do.
Sorry, I'm sneezing on everybody.
You do.
Okay?
I got to give you the CR vaccine.
That's right. Put me on a separate flight.
Okay, so this is going up on Thursday. I hope everybody has a lovely Christmas holiday and that everybody is safe and with the ones they love and gets to check out Maestro, you know, or do whatever it is that gets you through the week. Greenwald, I love talking with you today. I hope you have a lovely afternoon. Thank you to Kaya for producing us. And then, so we'll be back. We're taking Monday, Christmas Day off. And we'll be back next week, middle of the week, with some fun Slow Horses stuff for you. So that's the season finale of Slow Horses goes next week. And we are efforting to make something special happen for that.
Efforting. That's us.
Yeah. Yeah.